Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 27th of January. Last week, President Barack Obama signed an executive order to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And there's been a lot of news concerning Guantanamo Bay since that executive order last week. A report on Monday in the Washington Post that many case files of Guantanamo inmates were in disarray. European Union leaders willing to take in prisoners being released from the detention camp, but American authorities must show ex-inmates pose no security threat before they can be resettled. There's a report in Newsweek that the Pentagon is preparing to declassify portions of a secret report on Guantanamo detainees that could further complicate plans to shut down the detention facility. We'll talk about that. And we'll talk about whether or not Guantanamo Bay has, as has been written about by Matthew Alexander, author of How to Break a Terrorist, one of the reasons Al-Qaeda has been effective in recruiting terrorists. So there's a lot on the table this hour of our program, and our guest is Professor Scott Silliman. He's a law professor and executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Scott. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Should you care to send an email, I think you can do that. And that's at talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Professor Scott Silliman, hello again. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Kathleen.
Well, there's a lot of news on this front that comes day to day. Let's start with how effective you think Guantanamo has been in recruiting terrorists for Al-Qaeda. Has it been?
I think that argument has been made, and I think there's some substance to it, Kathleen. When you take an individual and you place them in a facility under very Spartan conditions like Guantanamo Bay, and you leave them there without any advice of lawyers and any communication with their families for 4 or 5 years, there is obviously the chance that they can become even more resentful of the United States, and that can fuel thoughts of terrorism. We do obviously know that one individual who was released from Guantanamo Bay and sent back to a rehabilitation program in Saudi Arabia, then ended up as the leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So there are some documented situations where people have come out of Guantanamo Bay and gone back to the battlefield. So we just don't know how much that is happening.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we know that? Don't we keep track of these people?
Well, you try to, Kathleen, but until they're caught or they surface in some kind of a public way, you really don't know how many are actually returning to the battlefield. There was a study, and it was anecdotal at best, that came out of the Pentagon a few weeks ago that said that perhaps up to 60 individuals who had been released from the detention center had returned to the battlefield to fight the Americans and our allies. That's not proven, but it suggests that there is at least a sizable number of individuals who are going back to the battlefield after being released from Guantanamo Bay.
Can you tell me what the process has been, or is this a closed process, to determine whether or not somebody should be released?
Kathleen, these are the combatant status review tribunals that had been conducted at Guantanamo Bay. There's also an annual review that goes on with each detainee to see whether they are of any further intelligence value and further, and more importantly, whether they continue to pose a security threat to the United States and the rest of the Western world. That has been going on, and there have been folks released from Guantanamo Bay through that process. Again, we don't know how many of them exactly end up going back to the battlefield. We'd like to think that many of them just go back to their home countries and no longer constitute a threat to the United States. It's very, very hard to get statistics on that because, again, these people, until they surface in a terrorist attack like the one in Yemen, or some other type of capture on the battlefield, we really don't know where they are.
I wonder why this is the case. It is a news report in Monday's Washington Post that many case files of the inmates at Guantanamo have been in disarray.
Well, I was aware of that article. I don't think it surprises me, again, because many of these detainees at Guantanamo Bay, their files were filled with very highly classified intelligence information, some information that came from other detainees at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, and all this was put into the files. And whether they were properly maintained and whether that was a priority for the military staff at Guantanamo Bay, again, with the access of other agencies like the CIA and foreign intelligence agencies who all came down to Guantanamo Bay, it is not a surprise to me that those files are not as orderly as those maintained by perhaps some of your listeners.
Right. I'm probably not included in that. But but I wonder, this seems to me as though this is a fairly important thing to do, to keep track of these people, to find out where they've been and whether or not we're going to release them. You have to have extensive files. I'm amazed that a lot of people weren't doing their jobs on something so important to the national security of the country.
Well, again, Kathleen, let me take the instance of the individual who ended up in Yemen. He was released back to Saudi Arabia. And then he went through a type of rehabilitation program in Saudi Arabia. So that much is known. But then somehow he migrated from Saudi Arabia back up to Yemen and took on his position in al-Qaeda in that country, which has a track record of being fairly unstable with regard to its continued detention of terrorists or alleged terrorists. They either are released or they're broken out of jail. So keeping track of individuals very much depends upon other countries where we send them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that link is broken, and I think that's probably what we're finding in some of those files at Guantanamo Bay.
I see. We also were having news reports yesterday that European Union leaders are going to take in prisoners if Americans can show American authorities that they pose no security threat before they can be resettled. And this ties into what we were saying earlier. Can you realistically promise that they pose no security threat?
Well, that's very difficult, Kathleen, and I think we need to point out to your listeners that there are really three groups of individuals at Guantanamo Bay. There are those for whom there is no concern. There is no concern that they will be terrorists. Those are the Uyghurs from China, mm-hmm. who the United States no longer classifies as enemy combatants. The problem with releasing them back to China is that we fear that they will be tortured if they go back, and our own laws prohibit us from sending someone back to a country where they'll be tortured. But those would be the type of individuals for whom there is no real security threat. At the other end of the spectrum are those perhaps 30 or 35 at Guantanamo Bay, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, for whom there is some evidence of criminality, evidence that could be used to bring a prosecution, whether it be in a military commission or a court-martial or a trial in the federal criminal trials of the United States. That is a small number. They will face a criminal trial in some type of form. The vast majority of those at Guantanamo Bay will never face a criminal trial. There is no evidence of criminality, no evidence that they ever committed a crime, but there is evidence, supposedly, that they are very dangerous people. And the State Department, even going back a couple of years into the Bush administration under Secretary of State Condi Rice, tried to work with home countries like Yemen and Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan to say, will you take these folks back, but put them under some kind of restraint, some restriction, because they're very dangerous. The response coming back to our State Department has been, you never charged them with a crime. Therefore, how can you expect us to detain them? If mm-hmm. you bring them back to us, we'll probably release them. That's caused a real problem for the State Department, because we have been unwilling to send them to a country that will not put them under some kind of restraint. And that's a very large proportion, Kathleen.
Hmm.
You've got 100 people at Guantanamo Bay who are Yemeni citizens, and that's a real problem in trying to figure out what are we going to do with those.
Mm-hmm. Let's take each of these groups in a little bit more detail, Professor Silliman, starting with what you were just talking about. If there is no evidence of criminality for these 100 people, how do we know they're dangerous people?
Well, simply because of things that they have said. Mm. They have claimed that if they were released, they will continue in jihad. They will continue to want to kill Americans. What they say is not a crime, but it clearly indicates evidence that they are very dangerous. This raises the whole debate, Kathleen, of what's called preventive detention. The United States has not engaged in preventive detention as a policy, but other countries do. And so, as your listeners may know, we are being asked, the Congress is being asked, should we bring some of these folks into the United States and keep them at Fort Leavenworth or keep them at a supermax prison in Colorado? Members of Congress are starting to balk at that and say, well, you know, maybe I don't want to have it in my district, maybe somebody else's district, but not mine, because that might just invite some kind of terrorist attack on that facility. But for very short detentions under immigration laws, the Patriot Act, we do not have a law that allows us to detain someone in the United States indefinitely without ever charging them.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something that Congress would have to consider if we adopted, if we chose to do that. On the other hand, I think the better option is to try to find a place outside the United States for some of these people, but to reach some kind of accommodation with their home of citizenship or some other country whereby there is some minimal surveillance conducted on these individuals such that the countries will agree to take them back but not necessarily put them in jail.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the European Union, you mentioned this, they have said, we will consider taking some of these people off your hands. I'm also hearing, Kathleen, that some of the individual countries are saying, well, maybe some other country in the Union, but not us. John Bellinger, the former legal advisor for the State Department, indicated a few days ago that one of the things that the European countries are looking for is, will the United States take some of these people into our country? And that'll be a sign that we would be joining the effort. I'm not sure we've made that commitment yet.
Mm-hmm. For those who... There is evidence, strong evidence, that they have been involved in criminality, those 30 to 35. Do we know what direction they're going? Will there be criminal trials in the United States? Who decides that? What do you think is the best course?
That's the open question for the Obama administration, Kathleen. And the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay have been suspended, or what we call continued, until the 20th of May to give the new administration time to sort out where it wants to send these folks.
Mm-hmm.
There are basically four options. One, you could restructure the military commissions and hold them somewhere, even the United States. I don't think that's a good option. I think they have become so tainted in the international community that they'll never be recognized as a legitimate trial. You could actually use the court-martial system, which is what Congress created almost 60 years ago for the trial of our own servicemen and servicewomen. The Supreme Court has affirmed that as a very fair system. I think it's looked at as a fair system in the international community. And you could hold courts martial outside the United States. You could hold them anywhere in the world, for that matter. A third option would be to try them in the federal courts of the United States, like Zacharias Moussaoui or Jose Padilla. We can do that. Those trials become very complex. They become very difficult. And most importantly, Kathleen, you would have to bring them into the United States in order to try them in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And that would be difficult because?
Well, I think there's a security issue involved.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason why there's a security issue in bringing them in for a preventive detention program. The last option that's being discussed is maybe to ask Congress to create what's called a National Security Court, which would not be like the regular criminal trials in the United States, would perhaps have less due process. I'm not sure I hear Congress supporting that. And again, I'm not sure that would be welcomed among our international allies, because it would be pretty much the military commission system being reblued. So I personally favor the court-martial system. I think that guarantees the security. You don't have to bring these very dangerous folks who have committed a crime or allegedly committed a crime into the United States, but you could prosecute them in a forum that is considered by all to be fair.
Mm-hmm. And those, like the people there from China who've been there for years now, why haven't we figured out something to do with the people who are of no concern to us? I don't understand that.
Well, we have resettled about seven of them, I believe, that there are perhaps 18 or 19 still left where we cannot find a third country. Again, we cannot send them back to China because international law and our own domestic law prohibit us from sending an individual to a country where we believe or have reasonable grounds to believe they'll be tortured. And that is true with regard to sending the Uyghurs back to China. So where do you send them? Which country will agree to take them? And that's basically the problem the State Department has had with regard to these folks who nobody believes are really dangerous.
Well, why wouldn't they come to this country then?
Well, actually, a federal judge, Kathleen, in the District of Columbia, ordered that they be released and was going to release them into the United States, ostensibly because they had families who were willing to take them in. The federal government stepped in, again, the Bush administration stepped in and said, no, we don't want to do that. If we're going to release these folks, they need to be outside the United States or we need to deport them to another country. So that problem has not gone away, and it's one for the the Obama administration to continue to have to deal with.
We're going to take phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. We're talking about the ramifications of the executive order signed by President Barack Obama last week to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. Our guest is Professor Scott Silliman, law professor, executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University. One line is open. 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Silliman, starting with Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. It would seem to me that the closing of Guantanamo on the part of President Obama was, you know, basically a political stunt. Now, it's true that it's a mess, and by having done what he did, I think he just made the mess worse because, you know, I mean, there is no plan. How about, Professor, if he uses his considerable political ammunition, so to speak, and why not dump this on the lap of the United Nations? You know, these are terrorists who are dangerous to, let's say, all of us here in the United States, in Europe. So why not dump it on The Hague? Why not dump it on the United Nations? Let the United Nations create a Guantanamo Bay, so to speak, somewhere, in some island somewhere, and process these people that way. Because we take the political hit, you know, in international opinion all the time, but, you know, nobody is willing to step forward and solve this problem.
That's an interesting question you asked, Mike. I'm not sure that the United Nations Security Council in this situation, would be willing to volunteer to do that for us. My sense, Mike, and only my sense, is that the United Nations is looking at Guantanamo Bay as something that we created, as something that has caused us a great deal of lack of credibility in the international community. And I think most of the world is saying, okay, United States, you clean this up because it's a creature of your choosing. You did this yourself. So even if the United States, even if the new administration were to go to the Security Council and ask for the United Nations to create some detention facility, I don't think that they would be willing to do that for the same reason that many of the other countries would not be willing to do that. They would say, if you're going to charge our citizens or charge the citizens of the world, do it. But we're not going to create an international preventive detention system. That would normally have to be done country by country. But, again, you say it's a political decision that the president made. I think it's more than that. I think there's a recognition that ever since Guantanamo Bay was established way back in 2001 and 2002, that the United States has been discredited in the eyes of many of even our traditional allies in the world. So whoever was going to be elected president, there was no question that Guantanamo Bay itself, the facility in Cuba, had to be closed. It has become a lightning rod for criticism. Now, you raise the question, what do you do with those folks? And that's what we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. It's an extremely complex problem, and that's why the president said not that it'll be closed tomorrow or the next week, but in a year's time, because it will take at least that long to sort out where we send these people.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. Jim from Galena, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for the call. I listen to your program all the time. It's a very good program. I'm an independent voter. I voted for both parties. I did vote for Barack Obama, and I'm glad I did. And I'm glad he's closing the prison camp down in Cuba. The problem I have with, you keep hearing the individual voters or the individual person in the United States say these people are terrorists. Well, we've had over 750 of them in the Guantanamo prison. We've released 500 of them, and they're constantly saying there's only 35 out of the 200 that are dangerous. That means about 85 to 90% of them that we picked up somewhere were innocent. Now, I don't know what the American people would think, but if you picked my husband or my wife up somewhere and paid ransom to some lord for $5,000 to $10,000 to turn me in, and he turned me in and the CIA paid him, and you put me in a prison for 6 years and I'm innocent, you've made another enemy. You've got to close it. You know, and there's 35 are left, put them in a federal prison somewhere and give them a trial.
Well, The question of whether they are innocent or whether they're dangerous is something that the military has tried to be sort out down there at Guantanamo Bay through these tribunal hearings. They're administrative hearings, not criminal hearings, both the Combatant Status Review Tribunal and the annual reviews. I should mention, and we haven't talked about it before, but last summer the United States Supreme Court gave those at Guantanamo Bay the right, the constitutional right, to come in and challenge their detention in the federal courts of the United States. And they have been doing that since last fall in the District of Columbia Circuit. Judges, and not liberal judges, but judges have been releasing, by order of the court, up to 24 of those at Guantanamo Bay by saying that there is an insufficient amount of evidence to justify that they are, in fact, enemy combatants. And people are saying, as you suggest, well, if there's no evidence and these folks were not enemy combatants from the very beginning, have we, in fact, maybe created a problem by holding them for 4 or 5 or 6 years? We don't know. Some of those, obviously, will become more prone to jihad than they otherwise would have been. But the first thing we've got to do is close Guantanamo Bay and figure out where are we going to resettle those folks.
Well, if you held me for 6 years in a prison, or my wife, or my child, or you know, my boys, I sure as hell wouldn't be a friend of the United States for the rest of my life.
Well,
that's the way I look at it, you know.
I think that's a real possibility, Jim, and I'm not discounting that. Again, it's very hard, as we said, to find out which are just going back to their homes and not taking up any kind of jihad, and those like the gentleman in Yemen who are taking on a much greater role in the terrorist network.
Do we have an understanding, Professor Silliman, after all these years, of how these people were rounded up and sent to Guantanamo? Who did it? If indeed a lot of people were paid, and who paid them, and where we found them, and all that information?
Well, we do know some, Kathleen. I can't answer for all of them, but particularly as far as the early ones that were captured in Afghanistan, when we conducted military operations in there starting in the fall of 2001, there was the Northern Alliance that were allied to the United States and against the Taliban government. And as Jim suggested with his comment about the CIA, the Northern Alliance would be paid up to $5,000 for turning over someone who they said was a member of the Taliban to the U.S. forces, and those folks would end up at Guantanamo Bay. Were they, in fact, members of the Taliban? We know that at least one who was released by the federal courts was not, that he was actually a true fighter against the Taliban. So you take the risk that the intelligence that you have or the intelligence that's provided to you by our allies is correct. And in some cases, it's not going to be correct, but it's very hard to find that out at the time.
Right. Thanks, Jim, so much for your call. Let's go to Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you. Good morning to you and your guest. I watched your testimony on C-SPAN in January of 2006, I think it was, and thought, you know, how lucky we are to have people with reasoning skills still in our government, and I thank you for that. I had a couple of questions. The people that we have released and then have captured, say we've caught them back on the battlefield, you know, you have gone over this a little. How many of them were actually, say, shepherds first and then said, like your last caller said, look, you know, I took up arms after you brought me in and tortured me. I wanted to get your comments on that. And also, a previous caller brought up bring these people to the UN. I found it interesting that the UN, the Special Rapporteur on Torture, Manfred Nowak, has said that he wants to prosecute Bush and Rumsfeld for the torture that has happened in Guantanamo Bay, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Okay, two excellent questions, Dave. First of all, I don't think we do know. Very candidly, I don't think we know who we might have brought in who was just an innocent shepherd we kept at Guantanamo Bay, and then return to the battlefield, because the intelligence that was used to initially bring them to Guantanamo Bay suggested that they were some kind of a terrorist fighter. And if, in fact, they were totally innocent, that information did not come out then, but is only coming out later. So I think it's very, very hard to make that determination as far as who was innocent at first and who we've turned against them. I think it is clear that there were probably some cases, but how many, we don't know. Now, your second question is excellent. The question of war crimes tribunals has surfaced not only in the international community with regard to President Bush and Rumsfeld and others, but it's also part of the debate in the United States. And the Obama administration has basically, I think, taken the position that rather than looking back at potential war crimes that might have been committed, that he intends through new policies and new programs like the executive orders that were issued last week that Kathleen mentioned, to repudiate the Bush Doctrine by doing something totally different, by saying we will treat people humanely in accordance with the Geneva Convention. We will ensure that wherever we detain folks, Guantanamo Bay or, more significantly now, the Bagram Air Base facility in Afghanistan, that the International Committee of the Red Cross will be allowed to come in. They'll have access to lawyers, that the detention facilities will be of the very highest standards, and these people will truly be treated humanely. I tend to agree with that. I think that when you look at potential war crimes against the Bush administration, we've got to remember that there were a series of legal memoranda that came out of the Justice Department that, whether you think that they were right or wrong, nonetheless the administration used to justify extremely coercive interrogation techniques in detention and the program of extraordinary rendition. So when you think of trying someone in a criminal court and they basically say, we were following the advice of our lawyers, and a statute involved passed by Congress in 2005 says in the statute that reliance on legal advice is a statutory defense to a charge, it becomes a very difficult concept to actually accomplish that. The international community, with the Obama administration, I think, seeking more support. You probably know, your listeners know, Kathleen, the president gave his first press interview last night to a Saudi Arabian television station.
Yes.
He specifically mentioned reaching out to Muslim countries in his inaugural address. I think he is trying very hard to establish new relations and new credibility for the United States and pushing this issue of war crimes investigations further and further away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, I thought that was extremely interesting. That was the first interview. Very interesting. Thanks so much for the call. I'm sure that you've seen this call, and it's not just from the author of Storming the Court, that what Congress must do, this visiting professor at NYU has said, is work with Congress to enact a federal statute that outlaws forever the use of Guantanamo as a detention facility because an executive order can be changed easily. What do you think of that?
Well, that's true. An executive order, President Obama, if he wanted to, could take an exception to it. We might not know. Practically speaking, Kathleen, I don't think it's going to happen. Guantanamo Bay is so visible to the United States populace, to the international community. It's not going to continue on to be a detention facility ad infinitum. It's just not going to happen. I think there are bills in Congress, in both the House and the Senate, even now, with a new Congress, to force the administration to use a particular decision-making matrix as far as who should be detained, where they should be detained, who should be released, who should be prosecuted. So the Congress is moving forward legislatively to try to pass a bill. The President of the United States has appointed task force and special committees and commissions to look at these issues. Everything is moving ahead very quickly. But again, I think we've got to realize that these are tremendously complex issues. We've already discussed, do you bring some of these detainees into the United States? That needs to be debated. I think everyone has to have a view on it before we do it, because that would be creating a preventive detention program for the first time in the United States. And once we start down that path, it's very difficult to turn back.
Mm-hmm. Joe is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention... You know, I've been listening to your show, and of course, I always appreciate it. But on listening to the speaker, you know, some of these folks from Duke University and Harvard, there's a larger law here at stake than just having experts with a putter's putt a ball around in this little legality green or this little legality green. I mean, the Bush administration killed off 500,000 children in Iraq by their embargo on medical supplies and. Their embargo, according to the World Health Association, so there we got 500,000 deaths. Eisenhower warned the American public about a industrial, military, congressional complex that starts wars in these countries to get the indigent Americans to go fight and die so they can make $10 a piece for these titanium bullets and so forth they sell. We know how much money the American taxpayer has given to these arm dealers by the shape of our economy here.
All right, Joe, can we go to Guantanamo, though?
And the mention of a battlefield, there is no battlefield except the battlefield America makes. Let America get out of Arabian business. Let the Arabs have their oil. Let America have their sphere of influence in the smaller European countries, because we're the dominant power that spends more money on the military than any of the rest of them. So we have a much bigger stick, and they better do what we say. But let's stay out of the Arabs' world, because I don't think that a bunch of professors sitting around tips-knitting with legal conversations is the real situation. I think the real situation is the United States.
All right, Joe. Well, we do have a real situation in Guantanamo, and our guest knows the legalities of this, and it seems to me as though it's a fairly important issue. So thanks for the call. Let's go to Jim from Pewaukee next. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Hey, I just want to make a simple point. I believe that the only people that are making this a lightning rod is the American left. And also, the only other people that have a problem with it also are the terrorists. And I think anything that we do in Guantanamo Bay isn't going to change any terrorist's mind. There's got to be a system for processing these people. I mean, what happens in the next year if we have just a slew of terrorist attacks, you know, bombing our malls and all of this? Guantanamo Bay is going to look like it's going to look like peanuts. We gotta deal with this problem. How can Guantanamo Bay not exist with what happened after 9/11? I mean, what were we supposed to do with these people? Put them on trial? See, it is a complex issue. It's very complex, and all of a sudden now it's a complex issue. As in the last 4 years or 3 years, it was just Bush is a criminal, but now all of a sudden it's a complex issue. I think there's a lot of bias going on. And the only people, again, that have a problem are the terrorists and the American left with this whole thing. It's a reality, and you have to deal with it. And now nobody has a better solution for it. I find it very fascinating.
Well, Jim, what about the people who are there? And indications are that there are quite a few who have nothing to do with terrorism.
Do you think the military was collecting these people on purpose? They had a reason, and it's not a perfect world. It's a terrible situation that they have to deal with. Terrorism is a very, very big deal. You have to have the upper hand on it. So you got to do the best you can. Mistakes and things are going to be, you know, problems are going to happen because of it. It isn't going to be a squeaky, clean operation. But I don't believe that the military was just rounding up people because they had nothing to do. These are good soldiers. These are good people. These are people with good intent. I don't believe this is a criminal activity. I mean, if you put yourself in those shoes, do you really think you'd be doing, you know, that these people are any less humane than you, the soldiers who are collecting these people? They seen them as a threat, and they did the best thing they could.
All right, Professor Silliman.
Yeah, Jim, let me address a couple of parts of your statement. One, I'm not suggesting in anything I've said that the military is to be blamed. I spent 25 years proudly wearing the uniform of the United States Air Force, and so I know those people. I respect them. I applaud them. But as we mentioned before, some of the information regarding who these alleged terrorists are is coming from outside the military. It's coming from intelligence sources that drive decisions. And further, I think what is very important to understand is that this new administration is having to deal with this problem because the courts are taking a stronger position. And these aren't liberal courts. The judge who released 24 individuals from Guantanamo Bay in Washington, D.C., is a very conservative judge. The United States Supreme Court, under a very conservative Chief Justice, John Roberts, last summer gave constitutional rights to those at Guantanamo Bay. The administration has to move out ahead of the courts, because even though I'm a law professor, if we let the courts drive American policy, we're going the wrong way. So I think the administration has to deal with this. It has to deal with what kind of a program, how we're going to deal with the next person we capture, how we are going to deal with those detained in the battlefield in Afghanistan. because there is a lawsuit right now involving whether those people should have rights to come into our federal courts. So the Bush administration is trying, did try, the Obama administration is trying very hard to get a cohesive program for detaining terrorists, both present and those in the future, that will satisfy the legal rules and the courts will not have to step in.
And thanks very much for your call. I mean, I find these statistics, and we're getting stuff all over the place here. It's hard to get a handle on the truth, Professor Silliman. But I was reading yesterday that, and tell me if you think this is way off or we just don't know, there were 759 men detained at Guantanamo over the past 7 years. The Pentagon has freed more than 500 of them. And we have very conflicting information about whether or not those detainees had ever committed a hostile act. I mean, releasing 500 of 759 is an indication to me that you got the wrong people there.
Well, that may be true, Kathleen, but remember that these releases have come in the last several years, and the screening tribunals at Guantanamo Bay look to whether the individual is a continued source of valid intelligence and whether they still represent a security threat. So it may be that someone came in there, a very low-level person like Salim Hamdan, the driver for bin Laden, who no longer, after 2 or 3 years, constituted a security threat tribunals conducted by the military. And so they might be someone who was released who was not totally innocent. So this is a very, very hard thing to determine. And again, the documents, the Pentagon will be, in fact, declassifying some of these documents, the files for the detainees. So we may be able to learn a little bit more. But it's always going to be the case that we will never know precisely who was brought in to Guantanamo Bay initially, who was a security threat, who then ceased to be a security threat and was released, and who was brought in erroneously and who was never a terrorist to begin with.
And what about whether or not we'll know if we did receive valued intelligence?
Well, I can't answer that, Kathleen. That's trying to prove the negative. In other words, it's the same thing as, well, we haven't had a terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11. Therefore, all the programs of the Bush administration have worked. And why should we change them? We should continue to use waterboarding, et cetera. I don't know how you can prove that and how you verify information. Obviously, the classic situation, the classic case of intelligence that was proven false was the WMD in Iraq, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that prompted the President of the United States to order the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. Intelligence is perishable. It is nothing but intelligence. It may or may not be totally true. But the problem is officials in government and in the military have to act on it as best they can.
Professor Scott Silliman is our guest, law professor, executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University. And we're talking about Guantanamo Bay this hour of the program. Thanks for your call, Jim. One line is open at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Tuesday, Eric Larson will join us. You may recall a conversation that we had with him as he completed or tried to complete a journey to the North Pole. He's a polar explorer and an educator. And this year, starting in just about a month or so, he's going to be quite an explorer. In the same year, he's going to the North Pole, the South Pole, and he's also going to be climbing Mount Everest. All of this to draw attention to the effects of global warming. So Eric is with us the second hour of our program. Back to phone calls. Rich from Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. My belief is, and I'm part of what I'm saying is in response to one of your previous callers, Jim. And Kathleen, you said we have a real situation at Guantanamo. If we do, it's a real situation of our own making. And we have some good informants who are telling us that it is that. After 9/11, we needed every person of goodwill on the Muslim street in the Islamic world, 1.2 billion people in the world, to be on our side. We needed to show respect for persons and for the rule of law. We set up a system of commissions numbers of people in the military, and I want to say that I respect and honor your guest's years of service. I believe I heard him say he served for 25 years, and I honor and respect that for anyone who dedicates themselves to something they believe in for 25 years. But I'd like your guest to comment on people like Lieutenant Colonel Daryl Vandeveldt, who quit because he said the process was so corrupt. Air Force Colonel Morris Davis, the former chief prosecutor for the military commissions, who basically said that he had been pressured to pursue sexy cases in the run-up to the 2008 elections, that is increasing the fear factor among the American public. In sum, I can't think of anything we could do better than dedicate ourselves to the closing of this corrupt system at Guantanamo and to tell our fellow Americans, you know, T. Boone Pickens is right. We're spending our treasury, our wealth, shipping it overseas for petroleum to people that we have disrespected and demeaned. And don't let anybody tell me that if you're flushing their holy book down a toilet, the Quran, that they're going to see that as some isolated incident, and that the military, American military, respects the rights of Muslims. I just think we've made a big mess, and we have to clean it up. And now it's up to President Obama to do so.
Okay, Rich, I totally agree with you. And I think one thing that you allude to that I want to say very expressly, the young men and women in uniform who have been performing the function of prosecutors like Mo Davis and the others, and the defense lawyers, have performed superbly. They have represented the interests of either the government or detainee to the best of their abilities. And if there's one ray of sunshine in the clouds that surround Guantanamo Bay, it's that the women and the men in uniform have done the job that we would want them to do. I think everyone now knows that many of the decisions regarding the military commissions and interrogation techniques, these were not young soldiers that came up with this on their own by reading some manual. These decisions came from a very high level. And when you're in the military, as many of your listeners know, a decision is made by a high level of authority, you carry it out, because that's what you're supposed to do, unless it is clearly illegal and you know it's illegal. So I applaud those in uniform at Guantanamo Bay and everywhere else. They are doing a very hard job, and they are doing what they are told to do by very high levels of authority. Mo Davis and the others who resigned as prosecutors, they did so obviously for reasons. I know all of them personally. I agree with what they did. The Guantanamo Bay Military Commission system, the system of trials down there, was flawed. There have only been two trials in the last 2.5 years, even after Congress reauthorized the program, simply because there were decisions made by civilians with regard to moving cases forward, and the prosecutors who should have been in charge of those trials were not given the discretion to make the decisions they should have made. So that's become very public. I think that's why, as I mentioned earlier in the program, I don't think military commissions will ever come back, because they have become anathema for the rest of the world as a symbol that we do not follow the rule of law.
Thank you, Rich, so much for your call. Porter from Madison, hi. Porter, are you there?
Yes, I'm.
Go right ahead.
I believe that that President Bush took us into Iraq, and whether or not we voted for him, all of America is responsible for dealing with the...
For dealing with what, Porter?
For the repercussions of what happened. That includes Guantanamo Bay. And we don't have the right to ask other countries to take in these detainees when we're not willing to do it. That we don't have the right to say, not in my backyard.
Mm.
If we're all Americans, we have to take responsibility for what happened. And that means in my backyard.
Professor.
Yeah, Porter, you are right. As I hope I mentioned earlier, some of the countries, particularly the European Union countries, within the last couple of weeks have said to the United States, you're asking us to take a portion of those individuals at Guantanamo Bay, and yet you yourself, the United States, have not brought any into your country. And that has become a block in the negotiations. That's the debate that is now going on in this country. It's certainly going on in the Congress of the United States, because in my view, Porter, if we are to bring folks into the United States and not bring them before a criminal trial, but just set up a system of preventive detention which may last for 10, 15, 20 years or more, I think the Congress has to pass a specific law authorizing that. We cannot rely on the existing authority of the President of the United States to do that if we're going to bring them into the United States. That's a debate. I think your voice and those of all the listeners to this program need to be heard on this, because it is, I agree, it's a national decision that needs to be made. Because once we start down this path, and some other countries in the world have preventive detention programs, it's very hard to pull away from it. So it's a very significant decision, one which we all need to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Porter, for your call. Jim from River Falls, hi.
Good morning. With respect to Guantanamo Bay, and I'd also include the black sites that we've got overseas where we detain people and subject them to extraordinary rendition. A lot of folks have been released. I think in the case of the Canadian guy who was taken overseas and was found to have done nothing wrong. If we're not going to hold our leaders accountable for these, what I consider to be war crimes or violations of the Geneva Convention, shouldn't our government at least do something in the way of reparations to these folks for the years that they've been taken out of their lives and the disruption of their families and the horrible treatment that some of them were put through? If we're, they say, show some contrition of some kind, if not holding the leaders accountable, then saying, we know we did wrong and here's what we're going to try to do to make up for it.
It's an excellent point, Jim, and let me cover the first thing you mentioned on the black sites, CIA black sites. The President of the United States on the 22nd of January, a few days ago, ordered that all those sites be closed. CIA sites are ordered to be closed by executive order. So I don't really see that happening again, and the CIA will not be able to do that. On the Arar case is the one you're talking about, and for the rest of your listeners who are not familiar with it, this is a Canadian gentleman who was picked up at JFK Airport, sent to the Middle East, where he spent about 10 months in very, very difficult conditions, allegedly was tortured, and then we found out that the information which we had received from the Canadians that began this extraordinary rendition was in fact false. The Canadian government awarded Mr. Arar $10.5 million because of the mistake and to compensate him for what he'd gone through. So far, the United States has done nothing on that, and we still have him on the watch list. But that case itself, Jim, is still pending in the courts of the Second Circuit of the United States, and we are all awaiting a decision by the Court of Appeals up there as far as whether there should be an opening of the facts involving Mr. Arar, and perhaps that will also lead to some consideration by the Congress with regard to clearly compensating someone who there was no question was not a terrorist. More to come on that later, I think.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the significance of and the reason for President Obama to make these executive orders so early in his administration?
Part of that, Kathleen, is a legal issue to try to stop the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay before they went further.
Mm.
It involves the issue of double jeopardy. Once you go so far in a federal type of tribunal like the commissions, then it would possibly bar a later trial in the federal courts of the United States or in courts martial. So there's a legal reason. More importantly, I think he wanted to make a very clear renunciation of the Bush Doctrine. And I think he had talked about it in the campaign, and he decided that this was a very pressing issue, just as important or perhaps almost as important as the economy, which he's trying to deal with as well. But I think the rest of the world was looking to see what this new president would do. And if there was any hint that he would continue the relations and the programs that the Bush administration had, there was going to be disappointment. Saudi Arabia, we already know that a very high official in the Saudi government had indicated that our relations with that country that we've always very much relied on to work Middle Eastern issues was in danger of being eradicated unless the Obama administration did something very, very significant. I think we saw that in the inaugural address with his mention of Muslim countries.
Yes.
And I think we clearly saw it in last night's press interview with a Saudi television station.
Mm-hmm. About a minute left. We'll take one more phone call quickly. Joe from Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I would just like to comment on those people who say 9/11 changed everything. We have to have Guantanamo because what else are we supposed to do with these people? And I would like to argue 9/11 has changed nothing. We've always faced threats. We've had piracy in the Native American savages. And unfortunately, we didn't do this with all of them. But in the case of pirates, what we do is we create laws that outlaw activities. We enforce the laws, and we bring these people to justice. So if we want to fight terrorism, instead of creating a war and hiding these people in illegal prisons and disregarding our values and ideals, arrest them and bring them to justice. That's what we're supposed to do with these people.
About 10 seconds, Professor Silliman.
Yeah, and this is the thing everyone's watching. Well, will the Obama administration move away from using the what we call the war paradigm, classic war, you use the tools of war, more back towards the criminal justice idea? Remember, the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 was dealt with as a criminal act.
Yes.
And dealt with in the criminal courts. We just have to wait and see. We're waiting to see how the new attorney general designate responds to the new president. Again, we're just going to have to watch and see what the administration does.
Professor Silliman, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Professor Scott Silliman is a professor of law, executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University, and spent 25 years in the military. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Robert Schroeder for producing this program, to John Treader for on-air production in Milwaukee. We'll return following the news here on the Ideas Network.